This is chapter 14 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smiley, and this chapter is entitled The Blink. Lord Lauderdale, that's the man we read about before, who became the sort of ruler of Scotland under King Charles II, and was a bad man. Lord Lauderdale had taken the control of Scottish affairs because Rothes and his colleagues were spoiling everything by their vulgar violence. Odd as it seems to find any relaxation of their sorrows coming from such a source, it was to be expected, therefore, that the Covenanters would have something of a breathing space. And so it happened. The 3 or 4 years which followed are known in literature of the persecuted by the quaint title of The Blink. Through the brooding clouds a few rays of sunshine forced their way, and the hearts of the downtrodden folk were warmed. In greater numbers than ever they met for worship on the hillsides and in the fields, crowding to hear the preachers who gave them the living bread and the water which has refreshment for all thirst. The mercy we shall see was mingled with new misery, and fresh causes of contention sprang up among the faithful, but for the time there was an easing of their burden. One improvement was the removal from military command of two officers who had gained an undesirable repute. Of the two, Sir William Ballantyne was the more savage. "He hath all this time," wrote Moray to Lauderdale, "been exacting money and bonds, driving cattle and harassing the innocent as well as the guilty." His reign of extortion was terminated. He was fined in order to withdraw from the country. From Paris he sent an angry little letter to the King's Commissioner. "I intend to some place where I may have the occasion to follow arms till your lordship's displeasure be removed. Hoping such is your justice, you will not desire without cause utterly to ruin a poor gentleman." But death met him before he saw Scotland again. He was at the siege of a beleaguered town in the Netherlands, and as he walked one day too near the hostile guns, the comrade called out to warn him of his risk. "Cannonballs kill none but fey folk," was his contemptuous answer. The word had just crossed his lips when a ball shot him through the heart, and his bravados were ended forever. The other officer, whose tyranny had a summary conclusion, was Sir James Turner, the author of The Pentland Rising and its attendant wretchedness. In spite of his eloquent protestations that a punishment he did not deserve was inflicted on him, he lost his place in the army, and if he escaped exile he had to live in privacy for the rest of his days. But the chief feature of these years of The Blink, when milder men and milder measures were uppermost, was the granting of the two indulgences, the earlier in June 1669, the latter in 1672. The indulgences had a kindly look, but they added immeasurably to the troubles of the church. What was it that they did? The parish churches, abandoned to the lifeless curates, were almost empty. The people discovered methods of listening to their own ministers, the friends whose adoption they had tried. But if this state of things continued, one of three consequences must ensue. Either the worship of God in the ecclesiastical buildings of the land would become obsolete, or a system of persecution must be inaugurated, more unsparing in its sternness and more prolific in its results, or else some degree of toleration must be extended to the Presbyterian preachers, and a way of return must be devised for them to the offices they had filled before Middleton's Black Art of Glasgow drove them to proclaim their message under the open sky. The last was the course preferred by the governors of the country, and thus the indulgences came into being. They were a permission to the outed ministers to reoccupy their charges. Those who declined to go for a sanction to the bishops were not to have the stipend, but only the manse, and were to receive an annuity from the nation. The ministry of those who refused to attend the episcopal synods was to be restricted to the parishes over which they were set. None was to admit to the sacrament of baptism or of the Lord's Supper anyone from a congregation outside his own parochial boundary. The indulgences were thus the king's authorization to covenanting ministers to take up afresh, under certain stringent conditions, their dearly loved work of preaching the gospel of Christ. Again, if they chose, their voices might be heard within the walls of those houses of prayer that were hallowed by innumerable sacred recollections. But the government would watch, would superintend, would control their language and their action. This state regulation was the fatal blot on the scheme, in the judgment of the majority of the men for whom it was designed. They had cause, they felt, to fear the Greeks, et dona Fernantes. To their authors, the indulgences appeared politically wise, and they were granted with some graciousness, but a freedom so cabined and guarded, a virtue so cloistered, was not what the Covenanters had suffered in order to secure. If they accepted it, they would allow to civic dignities the right of interference in the thrice holy religion of the Church. They would yield up to an external power the prerogatives which pertained to Jesus Christ alone. Nor was this likely to be the only melancholy result. Other harvests of mischief lay in the perilous seed. For example, who could prophesy to what lengths the intrusion of the state might go? Having once invaded the spiritual realm, she would return with a demand for new benefactions and would assert her domination in yet more offensive ways. Moreover, the indulgences could not be welcomed without dividing the adherents of the covenant. It was useless to expect that everyone would see in their niggardly promises a boon so rich that at any cost it must be coveted and grasped. There would be many soldiers of Christ too jealous of their master's honour to reap comforts for themselves at his expense, and thus those who took the liberty proffered them would put a sundering chasm between themselves and their brethren. It was a contingency to be contemplated with dismay. There was yet another evil which could be foreseen. Compliance with the king's proposals would only prove an incitement to Charles and his advisers to afflict the conventicles more mercilessly than before. What justification was there for conventicles at all? The statesman would ask, when the doors of the churches had been thrown open and Presbyterians were in the pulpits again. Look at it in what light they would, most of the Covenanters saw something ensnaring in the bribe held out to them, and they declined to profit by it. Singularly enough, Lauderdale found his first indulgence vigorously condemned from the opposite side of the ecclesiastical world. Alexander Burnet, the Archbishop of Glasgow, was a resolute high churchman, much more zealous than James Sharp for the independence of the spiritual realm. That the Privy Council should arrogate to itself the power of admitting the ejected ministers to their old places was, in his eyes, a wound inflicted on the Church. For it was she who ought to be entrusted with such duties, and no court of the nation could lawfully trespass on her domain. It was the favourite argument of the protesters, a clear-sighted commissioner averred, enunciated by a man to whom the protesters were as the abomination of desolation. But Burnet, Longi Fasces is the nickname by which he is known in the coterie of Lauderdale's bosom friends, won nothing but a mitigated martyrdom from his attachment to principle. At the Christmas of 1669 he was compelled to retire from his see. I, Alexander, Archbishop of Glasgow, he wrote, being sensible that my service in that province hath not been so acceptable to his Majesty as I could have wished, and that I cannot expect my continuance therein can be so useful to the Church as the necessities thereof at this time require, an intimation of his Majesty's displeasure being made to me by my Lord Commissioner, His Grace the Earl Lauderdale, I do in all humility make a surrender thereof, whether it were prelate or peer or presbyter who stood in the dictator's path. He was overtaken soon by chastisement, and the autocrat went on his regal way undisturbed. There were 42 of the banished ministers who availed themselves of the gate provided by the indulgence back into the churches from which they had been expelled. If, to borrow a phrase from Samuel Rutherford, they preferred the lower road of the valleys to the higher road of the mountains, it would be easy to speak too harshly of men who were swayed towards compromise and concession by many appealing arguments. But the issues of pain and strife which their braver spirited friends predicted revealed themselves only too quickly. Their conduct was condemned by the bulk of Presbyterian people as an acceptance of conditions ruinous to the privileges of the Church and to the headship of Christ. Kirkton sums up the more consistent view in a single pregnant sentence. The indulgence, he says, being derived from the king's authority, was judged a bitter fruit from a bitter tree. Henceforward, there was a new breach in the covenanting host. It was sore enough to have resolutioner and protester regarding one another with suspicion and winging their controversial arrows at each other instead of at the common foe. But now a second cause of heart-burning had arisen. Indulged and not indulged manifested a too scanty affection and were frequently engaged in verbal strife during the years to come. A fatality clung, one sees, to Lauderdale's gifts. and the boon became a bane, but probably the intention was generous, for during the blink he had for advisers three men whose names it is a gladness to recall, and who stand out in bright relief from the sordid crowd of needy nobles and ruthless soldiers and haughty churchmen. They lent character and refinement for one or two quickly fleeting years to the cause of absolutism, and they had within them what Middleton and Rothes and Sharp never had, or else has killed and lost, a heart of compassionateness and magnanimity. One of them was the Earl of Tweedale. In the Parliament, which condemned James Guthrie to die, he had the courage to vote against the capital sentence. Not but that I thought he deserved it, but some circumstances, as the disorders of the time, the general distractions of men's minds, and the fact that the restraining power of the laws was too sadly abated, and the execution of them loosed, did incline me to another punishment. For his boldness and humanity, he was thrown into prison in Edinburgh, and for 9 months from September 1661 until May 1662, the dungeon shut him in. Ordinarily, a man is seen either at his best or at his worst in his own home, and if we subject Lord Tweedale to this test, our liking for him is increased. In a delightful letter written to Lauderdale, whose one daughter was married to his son, he discloses most naturally and winningly his affection for children and grandchildren. He has returned to Yester after a period of absence, to Yester, where I found them all well and was quickly encompassed with children striving who should be most meed of. Charles is grown a mighty kind child and left all his frowardness, and I think the squints no more than he did. I asked John if he knew me. He said, "Aye, aye," and clapped my cheek and kissed both of them, and asked for his grandfather at London. Anne is grown a pleasant and beautiful child. My little daughter Jean, when she saw me make more, as she thought of the rest than her, said, "I am a bairn too." Such a letter opens a window into Tweedale's nature, and when we look through the panes, we see what is inviting and tender. Another of Lauderdale's counsellors was Alexander Bruce, second Earl of Kincardine, a statesman of insight and of integrity. It was his wish from the first to deal liberally with the Kirk, and if clemency could be shown without seeming to be extorted through the alarm of the government and the acknowledged strength of the Covenanters, he was prepared to show it. "I am, in my private opinion, for a qualified toleration," he declared, "but I would have it given and not taken, and I think it is not to be given so long as they think themselves so considerable as to oblige the granting of it. It would have been a rich benefit to the distracted country if Kincardine, with his rectitude and kindliness, had remained longer in office." He did continue with Lauderdale, from whose guidance of affairs he hoped for many reforms, after the other two had been forced to go, but at length his patience was worn out, and he broke with the commissioner, whose despotic exercise of authority and gross personal sins had grown repugnant to his own purer mind and sweeter temper. But the most attractive of the trio is Sir Robert Moray. The wonder is that so chivalrous a gentleman, Evelyn's dear and excellent friend, and the comrade of comrades to whom Thomas Fawn, the silurist's philosophic brother, left all his papers because he knew no one else whom he could trust with such fidelity. The wonder is that he should be found in conjunction with the persecutors at all. In truth, it was against his will that he engaged in the drudgery of politics, and was dragged away from employments and companionships more congenial. He loved his books, his chemical retorts, his music, his medical researches, and those familiar intimates to whom he could unbosom his heart with none of the diplomatist's concealments and equivocations. He was happier in his presidency of the Royal Society than in his toils and worries and disappointments as Privy Councillor. The Earl of Kincardine knew him well. The two had been as brothers during their season of exile before the Restoration, and no speck of cloud ever crept over the serene sky of their fellowship. One may read the beautiful letters which Moray sent to Alexander Bruce, while the one was in Maastricht and the other in Bremen, and whoever reads them will become a thrall to the enchantments of the fascinating scribe. They are luminous with wisdom, with humour, with wide literary culture, with unassuming religion. Experiment and scientific study are much more to the writer than all the intrigues of princes and parliaments. "Here I stopped," he says, breaking off in the middle of a story, to blow the coals in the stove under my feet, though I be sitting at the cheek of a furnace, will gar your eyen reel when you see it. He has unspeakable rest and comfort in his knowledge that there is not a jar, not a jealousy, not a disquieting element in their most satisfying alliance. I find it in my heart, he owns, to set every word I get from you in diamonds. He describes, with the enthusiast's devotion, his three fiddles hanging on the wall. But there in the strange land he can extract little satisfaction from their melody. To tell you truly, I am not much for cultivating a music till God send me days of joy and mirth, if at least he have marked out any for such for us. His friend at one time lies ill of ague, and he reminds him of what is the secret of consolation. You know whatsoever your kind, wise, good, and powerful father sends to you or does with you is the very best that can befall you, how dark soever his ways be to your grief or his touches to your relish. He talks of his own spiritual longings and strivings. I shall tell you it hath been my study now 31 years to understand and regulate my passions. The whole story of my progress in this and God's dealings with me in it will be as open to you as you would have it. In large measure, Robert Moray kept himself unspotted from the world. If further proof of it were needed, there is the fact that another cherished and reverenced correspondent was his sister-in-law, Anna Mackenzie, Lady Balcarres, exquisite alike in person and in mind. The man who could bind such friends to himself and could hold them unchanged to the end must have carried in him a crystal-lined soul. When 1660 came and Charles and Lauderdale leaped from poverty to power, they compelled Moray, unambitious as he was, to give them his help. Let us remember it to his Majesty's praise, when the witnesses to his discredit are legion, that he felt an extraordinary regard for one who had nothing in common with himself except the pleasure in chemistry and the brilliance in conversation that they both shared. As for the nobleman, he made Alexander Bruce's companion his own secretary, and consulted him always. In the summer of the Restoration year, he sent him across to France to secure from the French Presbyterians an opinion in favour of moderate episcopacy, and now, in his personal rule over Scotland, there was none on whom he leaned more confidingly, or who better deserved his trust. So long as such men got their will, there was little likelihood of excessive tyranny. But the blink, after all, was but a blink. It was not confirmed an abiding summer. As early as 1617, it was a new bit of savagery. The outcome of the indulgence of the previous year, to which Tweedale and Kincardine and Moray were somehow constrained to yield their consent. This was the act against conventicles. The ministers who persisted in remaining without the church were forbidden to pray and preach except in their own houses and among the members of their own families. If they dared to conduct a service of religion in a home not their own, they were imprisoned until they gave proof of their willingness not to offend in the like fashion again, and if the proof were not forthcoming, they were compelled to leave the country. Those who had attended the service were heavily fined, the master or mistress of the house being required to pay a sum, the double of that exacted from others. But the full weight of severity fell on the meetings held in the fields. The preacher there, or even in a building so crowded that some were standing out of doors, was to be punished with death and with the confiscation of his goods. Anyone arresting him was to receive a reward of £30 and to have a free pardon if, in performing his disagreeable duty, he had killed the minister or some of the obstinate and misguided listeners. Those who had been present at the field preaching were liable to fines extravagant and crushing in their amount. And under the terror of these exorbitant dues, the people were commanded to repair regularly to the worship conducted by the curates or by the indulged preachers inside the churches. It was the advent of winter once more. No roses, but only thorns today. And again the sons and daughters of the covenant were out under a frowning heaven. It is almost inexplicable that high-minded and gracious men like the three into whose faces we have looked should have stained their consciences and tarnished their fame by agreeing to the unjust act. We can only account for it by remembering the stronger will behind them which employed them as its exponents and agents. In fact, their brief and clement mastership was soon to be ended. Lord Lauderdale and they were to part company and go their separate ways. It was a woman's hand which sundered the ruler of Scotland from his best friends. His first wife, poor Anne Hume, died in 1671. He had sent her to France ostensibly for the benefit of her health, but more probably that he might enjoy the freedom which her absence would afford. Her last letter to him was written from Paris. It is a pathetic little epistle asking him to see that a house which she owned in Highgate should be repaired before it fell in ruins to the ground. He had filled the upper rooms with those multitudinous books of his, and it was unable to sustain so great a load, for what was it but a slim and paltry erection of paper? If he could not do so trifling a service for her sake, let him do it, she begged, for his own, for the place would belong to his family when she was gone. I have written many letters to you, she concludes mournfully enough. I shall desire an answer. Death came to rescue the Earl of Hume's daughter from the slights and sorrows of years, and to liberate her ungentle husband from the trammels of a union of which he was tired. In 1672 he married again. His new bride was the Countess of Dysart, a woman with plenty of brains but without any heart, who had a bad history behind her, and who for the future was to play Herodias to his Herod. She did not love him. She used him as a convenient tool to bring her money and applause. If he had been overbearing before, he became tenfold more so under his wife's evil influence. He lowered to her level day by day, until, as she was destitute of all that is holiest in woman, he lost all that is strongest and most righteous in man. It was a pitiful degeneracy, but there seemed no chance of checking its progress. Lady Dysart's jealousy drove Robert Moray from Lauderdale's side. Robert Moray, who had known how to touch pitch without being defiled, by and by there was a hopeless quarrel with Tweedale. In a few years more, Kincardine too said his farewells. Then that these ministers of conciliation and worth removed from the councils of the nation, hard came to hard, and the covenant has passed anew into an era of boots, thumbikins, and fire matches. Terrible tortures, terrible. The bloody rope to the neck, and bullets to the head. But the wise student of the time will be sorrier for their oppressor than he is for them. And the next chapter is entitled A Field Preacher.